The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to go through today, some important history, as well as recent history, as well as some news items to weave together with some of that history, and of course, with some scriptures, with what God says about our world today, specifically our nations, the United States and Britain in particular. Those of you that remember the late 1990s in the United States, all of the scandals happening there in the White House, and then the many lectures coming to us from commentators telling us that the character of the leader doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter what he does in his own private life or what he does in the privacy of his bedroom. It just comes down to, you know, does he have good policies? Is he establishing good laws for the benefit of the people? Is he smart enough? How he lives, not really that important. That was a constant refrain. And so you look at the world today, you look at our nations in particular today, and this is what character doesn't matter looks like. You're seeing it on display. Character doesn't matter, we were told over and again. Well, we weren't told that from God's church. If you remember, following all those scandals, really that's what led up to our booklets, Character in Crisis. I believe that came out in 1999 or 2000. I should have checked the copyright notices on these two booklets, but Character in Crisis, and then my father's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. Both of those books, we put those together following all of those scandals in the late 1990s. And of course, the message, in essence, was that yes, character does matter. The Bible says so. Even America's founding fathers said so. They had enough sense to know that if you don't live right, it's going to hurt the nation. Character in Crisis, copyright date 1998, I see. Right at that time, all the scandals, the impeachment. And here comes Character in Crisis. Again, no freedom without law. You think you have freedom when you take away the laws of God? You think you have freedom when there's no restrictions? We produced that in 2001. Right at that time, when our nations needed the message. But of course, most people just ignore God's message. They ignore God's truth. And we've continued on along that same course. What a slippery slope. This is what character doesn't matter looks like. We often refer to Alan Bloom's book, his classic work, The Closing of the American Mind. In fact, we had an article earlier this year on that book because it was the 30-year anniversary of that book. And he opens his book saying that there's one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes or says he believes that truth is relative. I mean, that he's writing that in 1987. This is before the 90s. Truth is relative. Truth depends upon, you know, the time you're in or the circumstances around you or what you think. He says, if this belief is put to the test, one can count on the student's reaction. They will be uncomprehending. That anyone should regard the proposition as not self-evident astonishes them. as though he were calling into question 2 + 2 = 4. These are things you don't think about. And so our young people, following tremendous upheaval culturally during the 1960s, they're coming into the university atmosphere in the late 1980s, according to Professor Bloom, with the firm belief that all truth is relative, that all morals are relative, moral relativism, right and wrong, good and evil, these are all constantly adjusting, ever-changing. Bloom says the danger students have been taught to fear from absolutism is not error, but intolerance. See, that's the worst sin, to be intolerant of any particular lifestyle. He says, finally, openness used to be the virtue that permitted us to seek the good by reason. It now means accepting everything and denying reason's power. You see, to have an open mind, it used to mean that you would seek after the good by reason, using reason. Now an open mind is just openly accepting anything and everything. Well, 30 years have now passed since Professor Bloom wrote his classic work. And look at, as I say, look at where we are today, a generation removed from when he first penned those words. Now, Herbert Armstrong, he was sounding an alarm a generation even before Professor Bloom came along. He was warning the United States and the world back in the 1960s. That this is a great tragic event, this pendulum swing to the other extreme, to the so-called new morality. He talked in his book, The Missing Dimension in Sex, about how important the family, the traditional family institution is. It's the foundation of any permanent and stable society. And he says all of that is coming undone. It's unraveling. And so we're on the way down and out. He said that the destruction of the family, or this downward plunge morally, he said it represented a greater threat to the United States than the hydrogen bomb. These are statements that Herbert Armstrong was making back in the 1960s, in the early 1970s. And time has proven, it's proven those statements to be certainly true. Look at Ephraim and Manasseh today. Look at the United States and Britain today. In the U.S., there's the epidemic of sexual abuse, sexual predators. And in the United Kingdom, in the U.K. right now, I mean, there's just a nonstop stream of articles about the transgender madness. What a sign of the times in which we're living. The Spectator this morning has a piece about those who would question gender fluidity, as they call it. If you question it, that's blasphemy. We've got to be, again, going back to what Professor Bloom said, we've got to be tolerant. We've got to be open to anything and everything. It says the capitulation of the establishment to the politics of transgenderism has been astonishing. I'm struggling to remember any other time when a new and contested ideology has been so uncritically embraced by the powers that be. See, that's the real shock here. And we covered this earlier in the week, I know. The Church of England, the government, health officials, educators, everybody at the top of society here in the UK, just fully embracing it. No questions asked. You can't. I read that story the other day where parents were afraid to come forward. Once their children getting into the NHS are just scooted on through to the transgender clinic after like a 45-minute discussion. And then the parents are like, what's going on? They want to sound the alarm, but they have to do it anonymously. Otherwise, they're attacked. We have a Tory government that says pushing a gender recognition act that would allow anyone to change his or her gender without so much as popping a hormone pill. It's just what they say. If they say it, then that's the bottom line. That's the truth. That's the absolute truth. If the boy says he's a girl, then you go through anything and everything necessary to accommodate that. An established church, which yesterday issued guidelines to its schools encouraging them to let kids explore gender identity. Police forces exchanging helmets for caps because gender-based headgear is disrespectful to trans people. And of course, a university system, the nurturer of future leaders, in which women's colleges are throwing themselves open to people who are born male. Students are told to use gender-neutral pronouns, and anyone who says men cannot become women can expect to be hounded off campus. So where is there any sector of society standing up for truth, absolute truth, God's truth? The Spectator says here, from the stuffy Tories to the armed wing of the state to the actual Church of England, one by one, the core institutions of the nation have accepted an idea that we really should have more debate about. Shouldn't we? I mean, shouldn't we at least be discussing this? Shouldn't there at least be a debate? Well, hang on a second. This goes against all of society's norms for centuries. Shouldn't it at least be up for discussion? And the answer is no. That children should be allowed to decide if they're male or female? I mean, shouldn't we consider this? What are the ramifications? Where is this leading? And that men who transition into women are actual women, full-on, legally recognizable, going into women's changing rooms women, rather than trans women? I mean, it's not that they're even trans women. They're just women. If they say they're a woman, they're a woman. No questions. That's where we are. It says anyone who claims that trans politics is edgy is kidding themselves. It is one of the most established protective ways of thinking of our time. Indeed, raise so much as a peep of criticism of the ideology of gender fluidity or the wisdom of chest binding for teenage girls who think they're boys, or whether primary schools really should let little lads wear dresses to school, and you will be shot down with accusations of transphobia. Even to suggest there are two sexes and that one cannot really become the other, to state what many people consider to be a biological fact, is to risk being branded with the phobia tag. Many people consider this a biological fact, but few can speak up and say it. Certainly not in those environments that I just described. The church, the university, in government, politics. It says so protected is the dogma of transgenderism that it now effectively enjoys its own blasphemy law. Nowhere is it more worrying than in schools. Well, that's where it starts. As I read earlier this week, I mean, they're going after the 2 and 3-year-olds. They've got to be brainwashed early on. And so they're teaching them this. And if you're one that asks a question, you're going to be scooted on out. Just like that Christian teacher in Oxford facing the disciplinary action for misgendering. That's his crime. Misgendering. It's so bizarre, the Spectator concludes, we don't trust kids to walk past chicken shops or read difficult literature, but we think it's cool for them to choose their sex. Mm-hmm. Just give them that responsibility, that right. Finally, it says, let me make this as clear as possible. Trans adults should enjoy the same rights as every other adult, and by the same token, their ideas, their beliefs, their faith should be subjected to the same levels of criticism and even ridicule as everybody else's. Well, that's what this writer at the Spectator's calling for, and that's not the solution either. But it shows just how bizarre it is, how upside down it is, how lopsided it is in the direction of these bizarre behaviors. And the fact that it's, as he says, now entrenched into the educational system, nowhere is it more worrying than in schools. Melanie Phillips had a piece today on the deconstruction. Well, same thing, I guess. The deconstruction of humanity, saying that, look, if you're tired of all the complicated details of Brexit negotiations, how about looking at the spectacle of the Western world tearing apart the very notion of what it is to be a human being, Melanie writes. And she brings out some of the same points as the Spectator. Regarding transgenderism, the knee-jerk bullying, victim groups, sectarianism, and repudiation of reason itself over transgenderism defy belief. I mean, you just can't believe it. Intimidation by transgender activists in the laughable cause of promoting greater tolerance and inclusivity has suddenly become the new norm. Examples such as a Christian math teacher who was suspended. Well, she goes through some of the same examples we've been reading about here in the UK this week. She says, as has been noted elsewhere, the really extraordinary aspect of all this is the way in which the establishment, conservative government ministers, conservatives, mind you, conservative government ministers, schools, universities, and the Church of England are meekly falling into line with the hallucinatory requirement enforced by coercion, character assassination, and social ostracism against anyone who dares resist that we deny the fact that we belong to the sex into which we were born. If you speak out, if you dare to resist, you can expect to be ostracized. You can expect for your character to be assassinated. Listen to what she says here. The reason for this existential collapse is that the relativist West has so heavily bought into the belief that reality is merely what we decide it to be. Here again, going right back to what Alan Bloom, what he wrote about in 1987. I mean, if there's one thing you can count on, if there's one thing you can be absolutely certain of, it's that every student's going to enter the university saying that truth is relative. Truth is changing. She says, everything is instead a matter of opinion and individual perception. You decide. Where have we heard this before? Melanie says, feelings trump facts every time. Feelings. No one's lifestyle is to be considered wrong or inferior to anyone else's. No judgment is to be permitted except for the judgment that judgmentalism is wrong. You can't be judgmental. That's the one sin that won't be tolerated. She says, what is right for me is what is right. What I declare something to be is what it is. I feel, therefore I am. She's basically describing Judges 21 and verse 25. It happened in ancient Israel. It's happened to other societies before us. when all of the standards and the strictures for morality just come crashing down. It happened in Rome. It happened in Greece. It happened in ancient Israel. Every man did what seemed right in his own eyes. That's what they did anciently. And what did it lead to? Well, in the case of all of these empires or kingdoms, God's recorded this. Paul brings that out in 1 Corinthians 10. He's recorded this for our benefit, for our learning, that we might not make the same mistakes, that we might not repeat the same history. God loves mankind. God loves our nations. He loves our people. He doesn't want us to go down this road. He wants there to be a foundation underneath our society, our nations, strong families, righteous rule, holy commandments. You do away with all that, and what are you left with? Well, you're left with a society that's built on, hey, character doesn't really matter. What you do, how you live, it doesn't really matter. You've just got to tolerate any kind of behavior. You've got to be accepting. You've got to be open-minded. You've got to know that truth is relative. You've got to be able to make value adjustments. Melanie says here, people declared themselves answerable to no moral authority beyond themselves. Human beings would now make, she's describing this progression that we've been on. Human beings would now make it all up as they went along. Since sexual procreation is the way in which a society replicates itself, in order to change the society, the rules governing sexual procreation had to be junked. It's not just that gender is fluid, as she brings out in her piece. Humanity has become fluid. Humanity itself. Anything goes. Everything's subject to being turned upside down. Well, that's, again, from Melanie Phillips's website today, an article she posted on her own site. And these articles, together with the ones that I'll get into in the next segment, they prove the truth of those statements that Alan Bloom was making back in 1987, and Herbert Armstrong long before him during the 1960s. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments, as always, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG, 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Herbert Armstrong talked about the moral decay in this nation, and Britain especially. And he says it is a worse problem. He said this in 1981. It's a worse problem than the nuclear bomb. Because it's immorality and spiritual problems that cause nations to fall. They fall from within before they're conquered from without in almost all cases.
That's the progression. They fall within first, and then they're conquered from without. That clip's from my father's program earlier this year, the Matthew 24 prophecy. You can get to that at thetrumpet.com. All of his videos. But we're talking about spiritual problems that cause nations to fall. The death of great nations. And we're seeing the sickness, as I said in the first segment. It's just on full display. Sexual predators all over the place. The workplace, Hollywood, Congress, the university. Isn't it interesting that all of these liberal commentators are now coming forward about Bill Clinton's character problem? His problem with character, something that we wrote about in 1998 and 1999. We're going to repost an article today, by the way, America in Crisis. It's from March of 1998. My father wrote it. Soon after all of these scandalous allegations were made known, and then they resulted in an impeachment. You need to read what he had to say about it. It's a powerful article. I'll give you some excerpts a little bit later on. But now, I mean, you've got an MSNBC host. You've got a columnist at the New York Times. A journalist over at Vox. All of these liberal sites. And they're coming forward saying Bill Clinton should have resigned. Bill Clinton was a rapist. Bill Clinton did this. He did that. And we should have called him on the carpet 20 years ago. Well, how easy is it to say that today? And really, you have to even wonder if they'd even be saying it if the election would have swung just a little bit in the other direction a year ago. If Mr. Clinton was residing in the White House again, do you suppose all of these commentators would come forward the way that they are? It's a good question. It's something to think about. It's awfully convenient to do it now when these same journalists are on the attack looking for others that they can bring down, other scandals that they can uncover. Even Harvey Weinstein, he's the one that sort of triggered all this in many ways. He was in tight with the Clinton family, close to the Clintons socially. You wonder how much of this, as bad as it is, would even see the light of day if the circumstances were just a little bit different. Because remember, truth is relative, right? Truth can be adjusted. If the circumstances are different, if the guy in charge is really helping us to get our program, our agenda accomplished, then you've got to give him a pass. That's the message we got in 1998 and 1999. Character doesn't matter. Now all of a sudden it matters, at least judging by statements. But do you think there's going to be wholesale change? Do you think there's going to be repentance from the heart? Do you think we're going to get back to the Bible and what God says about marriage and family and sex and dating and preparation for marriage? Do you think we're going to get back to commandment keeping? Jim Garrity had a piece at National Review talking about just how convenient it is now to pounce on Mr. Clinton or Ted Kennedy or Harvey Weinstein. It's safe to do it now. He talks about this movie. I haven't heard anything about it until I read this, but there's a historical drama coming out, Chappaquiddick. I guess it gets out in April. But he quotes from one of the reviewers of this film, a reviewer that I would expect to be somewhat liberal in his thinking. And this reviewer says about the forthcoming film, Chappaquiddick, Ted Kennedy should, by all rights, have stood trial for involuntary manslaughter, which would likely have ended his political career. The fact that the Kennedy family, the original post-war dynasty of the 1%, possessed and exerted the influence to squash the case is the essence of what Chappaquiddick means. The Kennedys lived outside the law. Those are the facts. And they are facts that liberals too often have been willing to shove under the carpet. And so here's a movie that may dramatically change the opinion, many have, of the so-called Lion of the Senate. Beloved by both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans alike. Hero worship, practically. Garrity says here, considering the ongoing reverence for the Kennedy family and so many powerful circles in this country, Chappaquiddick is a brave film, but it would have been much braver, perhaps impossible to make a decade ago. Where was the message 10 years ago? Where was this truth being told 10, 15, 20 years ago? It says, if the spring brings a reevaluation of Ted Kennedy, it will probably come on the heels of a sudden and dramatic reevaluation of Bill Clinton as a consequence of the explosion of sexual harassment and assault allegations in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And so he quotes from the New York Times piece the other day by Michelle Goldberg, who brings up some of those allegations from the 1990s, Juanita Broderick's in particular, the one who accused a president of the United States of rape. And this liberal columnist at the New York Times says, now I believe her. Now I believe her. It says in Jim Garrity's piece, a New York Times columnist declaring in print that she believes the 42nd president of the United States is a rapist ought to make people stop and think. But since we're seeing a tide of slime from predatory men gradually oozing out of Hollywood studios, television networks, and state capitals, it seems fair to ask whether Clinton's experience left many powerful and abusive men convinced that they could escape serious consequence. That's really what happened in 1998 and 99. No consequences. And so is that good for the health, the moral health of the country? When those at the very top get away with it? When there are no consequences? Can the country carry on as normal? Or does that sort of behavior filter on down? Let me play you this clip from, here's another New York Times columnist. This is David Brooks last week on Charlie Rose's show. And they discuss the Clinton presidency and listen to this exchange, clip one.
How much did tolerance of Bill Clinton create the environment in which the rest of this was given permission?
How much do you think?
I think it had effect. I think the fact that nobody liked was approving of Bill Clinton and some of the things he was accused of doing by Kathleen Willey and those sorts of people. But people were not saying, no, we're drawing the line here. And if you don't draw lines in these big cases, then you don't draw lines in the little cases.
So he says there that something should have been done, and you can see it filter down if you don't do anything, if there's no consequences. But he also made the comment there that, you know, it's not like anyone was approving of that behavior. But on the other hand, you look at the end of 1998. This is the year he's impeached. And Bill Clinton registered on a CNN USA Today Gallup poll as the most admired man in the country. He was the most admired man in the United States. This is what my father addressed in that 1998 article. He said, look, okay, this is going on in the White House, but look at the rest of the country. Why is this tolerated? I've mentioned this this comment before from Paul Weyrich. His response in early 1999 about the Clinton scandals and such, and he basically came out and said, look, here's a right-wing conservative. And he says, look, we've lost the culture war. We've lost it. A similar point that my father made. As I say, we'll get to his article here in just a second. Weyrich said in 99, the culture we're living in becomes an even wider sewer. He went on to say that it just overwhelms politics. I don't have the answers or even all the questions, but I know that what we have been doing for 30 years hasn't worked. I mean, he was fighting in the culture wars. I mean, we hear about the culture wars today, but what principles of God's law are we fighting for? None. None. He says, I know that what we've been doing for 30 years hasn't worked, that while we have been fighting and winning in politics, our culture has decayed into something approaching barbarism. I've read that quote a few times before. It's a powerful, powerful quote. That's what he said in 1999, almost 20 years ago. 20 years on, and this is what it looks like. Character doesn't matter. Listen to this exchange. This is going back to 1999. This is Dan Rather before the scandal that he was involved in with the false document to try to bring down George W. Bush. But here's Dan Rather when he was still somewhat respectable as a newsman. And this is an exchange he had with Don Imus on the radio in early 1999, clip two.
So even this Juanita Broderick thing that this interview that the people over there at NBC News have been sitting on for some reason, who knows, but...
Well, I think the reason is pretty obvious that they don't call me and tell me why they run or don't run these things. I think it's pretty obvious they're nervous about, number one, whether this information is accurate, whether it's really true or not. And then, number two, even if it does, it turn out to be true, that it happened a long time ago. And number three, they got to be figuring maybe the American public has heard all they want to hear about this and are saying, you know, next, let's move on to the next thing.
That's Dan Rather in 1999 saying that, well, maybe NBC's sitting on it because they're not sure it's true. Okay, that's a valid reason. And then he adds to that, even if it is true, it happened so long ago. I mean, is this really newsworthy? In other words, is this really newsworthy? And furthermore, and I think this is the one area where Dan Rather was probably right. The American public has heard all that they want to hear about this. They've heard enough. And so let's move on. And America did. And did America get healthier morally? Did America move on and become more righteous and draw closer to God? Well, back at that time when it really did benefit the feminists and the progressives, the Clinton administration, I mean, he had so many defenders in the media. I mean, the feminists even as women were being abused and taken advantage of, the feminists were defending him, top to bottom. This Jim Garrity piece, he says, the United States has seen infamous and widely covered allegations of sexual harassment before, but in 1998, well, he just describes what happened in 98 and how the Clinton machine just absolutely smeared all of the women that came forward with complaints and in a vicious way, calling them trailer park trash. James Carville was quoted as saying, drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, and you never know what you'll find. I mean, these women were just lying worthless. And then, of course, the president himself, lying and lying under oath, lying in front of a television camera. Why did he do that? Garrity says he did so because in January 1998, admitting to even a consensual relationship with a 22-year-old White House intern would have spurred bipartisan demands for his resignation. I mean, the standard was just barely high enough then, where even if it was consensual, he would have been called on to resign. At least we thought the standard was that high. But he lied because he thought that might be what happened. Well, then finally the truth was known. He's impeached in the House, but not convicted in the Senate. Dusts off his hands and moves on. No consequences. Garrity says there was a time when there was a broad cultural consensus that a man in a powerful position is not supposed to look upon his female subordinates as a potential harem. And if Clinton saw Lewinsky as a sexual plaything in the workplace, it's plausible he could have been less concerned about consent from other women in earlier years. He says a few days ago, Matt Yglesias of Vox articulated what was heresy on the left during those years. And he quotes this Vox writer, "I wonder how much healthier a place we'd be in as a society today if Bill Clinton had resigned in shame back in 1998. Well, it's at least refreshing to hear or see or read that in writing today, but where was it 20 years ago? And as Garrity brings out, correctly so, to articulate that 20 years ago or 19 years ago, that would have been heresy on the left. Well, it did filter down. It does matter. Character does count. And what happens to nations when character is in crisis? Here's his concluding quote. Right now, this is Jim Garrity at, Right now, we're indeed having a reckoning about a long time blind eye to powerful men abusing women, but it's occurring on the most convenient terms for the Democratic Party. When Kennedy is dead, Bill Clinton is retired and fading into memory, Hillary's prospects are done, and her closest network of supporters now largely live on the ash heap of American political history. Funny how all this worked out so conveniently for the party. Well, at least they're saying something now. But it is very convenient to bring it up 20-some years later when nothing really matters anymore. There's no consequences. Just like in 1998, there's no consequences today. If the liberals bring it up in the New York Times, at Vox, or at MSNBC, there's no consequence. If anything, it might lend credibility to their charges against someone else, maybe on the Republican side. Who knows? I mean, we've got to be fair and balanced. We don't want to be perceived as biased. Whatever the motivation, it's not getting to the root cause of this problem. My father, in that article from 1998, America in Crisis, make sure you go and read that again at thetrumpet.com today. He mentions in this article how, you know, there's a few that were shocked at what was going on in the White House, but then he addresses another much bigger problem. The fact that the general reaction in the public, among the people of America, well, they weren't really that appalled by what was happening. He refers to that approval rating, the high approval rating that Mr. Clinton had at that very time, at his absolute low point politically, morally. He was very popular. My father says this. This alleged White House scandal is not just about the White House, it's about America and Americans. It's about all of us. It's about you. The American people's response is a frightening portent of our nation's future. If we fail to understand, that doesn't make the bad news go away. What does it say about our future? If this is going on in the nation's capital and people are just ho-hum about it, he says, what happens to nations when they reach the stage where they don't care about private morals or character? Our Constitution was structured only for a people with strong character. Our constitutional system will collapse without pure morals. And then he gives some important history. He quotes from some of the founders. He quotes from Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren from the 1950s. Going back further than that, John Adams, George Washington, James Madison. You do away with religion and morality, as the founder said, and the American experiment, it won't last. There was an article earlier this week at the New York Times about Congress and all of these lurid stories of sexual harassment coming out of Congress. I mean, this is not something that happened 20 years ago or 40 years ago. This is happening right now. It says in the New York Times, in the run-up, about 1,500 former Capitol Hill aides, 1,500, have signed an open letter to House and Senate leaders to demand that Congress put in place mandatory harassment training and revamp the Office of Compliance, the legislative branch's opaque in-house adjudicator. And so there's this process. If someone's harassed, and you may have seen reports earlier this week too, the $15 million hush fund, it's been called, paying people, paying those who've been harassed, aides, interns, inside the halls of Congress, Washington, D.C. Well, I don't have time to get into all the details. Maybe I can come back to this article at a later date. But it goes through the process that a young woman would have to go through to file a complaint. There's hearings going on. There was one congresswoman, I should have gotten the clip, I suppose, but from a couple days ago, she says there's two members of Congress right now. Right now, current members, accused of sexual harassment, accused of worse than sexual harassment. Does it filter on down to every sector of American society? I mean, if the leadership leads the way, if Hollywood leads the way, and then if these scandals happen and most people could care less, like my father brings out in that 98 piece, what does it say about America? It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's like Paul said at the end of Romans, even if you're not doing it yourself, you're applauding those who do. Read that at the end of Romans 1. And so God says we're all guilty. We all have played a role in this. We're all part of the problem. That's what God's trying to show us. That's what he's trying to teach us. My father says in that article, America may not care about the morality of our leaders, but what does God think? Does he really care? He does. My father goes through quite a few powerful Bible verses in that article. As I say, we'll post that for you at thetrumpet.com later today. Jeremiah 23 and verse 20. The anger of the Lord shall not return until he have executed, until he have performed the thoughts of his heart in the latter days. You shall consider it perfectly or understand it thoroughly. You're going to understand it in the latter days. You're going to understand when these prophecies are fulfilled. When we destroy ourselves from within, and open ourselves up to invasion from without. When those things happen, you're going to understand. Well, what is God talking about in Jeremiah 23? What are the sins he addresses? In verse 14, it says, I have seen also in the prophets of Jerusalem an horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies, adultery and lying. They strengthen also the hands of evildoers, and none does return from his wickedness. They are all of them unto me as Sodom, and the inhabitants thereof as Gomorrah. They are all of them unto me as Sodom, all of them. That's what my father stresses in his article, the condemnation. It's aimed at everyone. And then he looks at the pornography that America produces and spreads over all the earth and how it's gone mainstream and how it obviously undermines the family. I mean, you'd have to be a fool, my father says. You'd have to be a fool to fail to see how pornography rips apart families. A lot of people don't think there's any harm in it. And look at what it's doing to our families. Look at what it's doing to the foundation of our nation. He mentions this example. I think it was from the New York Times in 1998, referring to David Boren. He was a former U.S. senator himself. And at that time, 1998, he was the president of the University of Oklahoma. And he's paraphrased, or he's paraphrasing an exchange that he has with his students in his American government class. And he asked the young people, this again is in 1998, when all over the news you had, well, she said this, but then the president of the United States said this. Who's telling the truth? Who is lying? And according to Mr. Boren, a teacher at a university, he said that students would typically respond, all politicians are crooks. I mean, they believe the president was lying. And then they would say something like, all politicians are crooks. Very few of them tell the truth. Few of them are faithful to their spouses. So why not have one who's smart and knows how to get things done? And then Mr. Boren says, that's almost an exact quote. That's the way our young people reason. What was it that Professor Bloom said in 1987, one thing you can count on is that almost every student entering into the university believes that truth is relative. It can always be adjusted, you see. They're all crooks. Let's get a smart one in there. Let's get one that has some charisma, and let's get one that can really carry out our political objectives. That's all that matters. Well, David Boren, to his credit, said, you know, this is deeply disturbing. I mean, we need leaders of character. He said in that New York Times piece, we've passed from anger about what's going on in our political system to cynicism and alienation. To me, cynicism and alienation are more frightening than anger. And then my father says, these students believe the president committed adultery and lied, and it makes no difference to them. It makes no difference. Many in America at the time were almost laughing at the scandals. The late night comedians, I mean, they had so much material, a nonstop supply of ready-made jokes. But God wasn't laughing. Here again, that verse, Judges 21 and verse 25. Every man doing what seemed right in his own eyes. My father, by the way, in his article, he makes a profound point about that verse in Judges. Every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. What does that mean? My father, see if this doesn't perfectly describe our nations today. He said, that means the people didn't trust their press. They didn't trust their politicians or their religious leaders. The big question is why? The answer is in today's headlines and all around us. The people were deeply degenerate and cared only for themselves. That led to their downfall. The leaders couldn't call upon the people to make deep sacrifices in desperate times. The people didn't trust the leaders. Distrust all the way around. Don't trust the leaders. Don't trust the press. Don't trust religion. That was my father's take some 19 years ago in his classic piece, America in Crisis. We're going to repost that today at thetrumpet.com so that you can read what we said following all of those scandals coming out of the White House back in early 1998. Make sure that you visit thetrumpet.com today to read America in Crisis. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.